custodians of the planet, acknowledge and pays respect to the past, present, and future traditional custodians and elders of this nation, and the continuation of cultural, spiritual, and educational practices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. You are with Custodians of the Planet. I'm Denise Yildiz. Custodians of the Planet brings consciousness to planetary challenges and looks at different perspectives regarding the tensions and harmony of human activities in a changing climate.
The climate crisis demands innovative approaches to facilitate a timely transition within our society. Unfortunately, there is a lot of room for improvement in our current transition efforts. So the question remains, how do we accomplish this? At its core, tackling climate crisis rely on the decision-making processes both at individual and societal level. Every decision, whether on a small or a large scale, matters and contribute to tackling the multifaceted layers of existential challenge. Today, I'm very excited to explore some seriously cool topics like mindfulness, politics, and planetary health. Jamie Bristow joins me on the line. Jamie is an expert on inner development and contemplative practices in the public sphere. For 8 years, he was the director of the Mindfulness Initiative and clerk to the UK's all-party parliamentary group on mindfulness. He now leads the charge in public narrative and policy development for the inner development goals team. Jamie, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Hey, good morning. Really nice to be here.
It seems like you had quite the journey to get to where you are today. Can you take us back and share some key moments that shaped your path?
Wow, what moments to pick, hey? Well, once upon a time, I was in university and I joined the Meditation Society along with about like 30 of, you know, other societies, as freshers often do, to just try out new things. And I was lucky enough to be taught meditation around the age of 18, 19. I didn't think that much of it. Like, it was interesting. Like, I could close my eyes and after half an hour or so, the world would feel quite radically different in some cases. And that was, yeah, really interesting to me. But it didn't become a big part of my life really until a number of years later, I was working in advertising. So I was an advertising executive making, you know, creative commercials. And I simply wanted to be better at doing that job, wanted to work longer hours. I was finding that the alcohol everyone was drinking to get over the day's work and then the coffee to get over the alcohol, etc., was undermining my ability to concentrate at my desk. And in fact, I kind of I have a kind of tendency towards ADD. Like, looking back at my school years, I could definitely have been diagnosed, I think, now that that diagnosis is more popular. And so I meditated more regularly in order to be better at advertising, in order to literally to sell more SUVs. I was working for Nissan for about 18 months and I got what I wanted. So that was kind of a couple of big, you know, turnaround points for me. Was this coming into my life and having a reason to really commit to it? Perhaps the wrong reasons, but like most people come to it, you know, meditation or mindfulness for some kind of self-regulation benefit. So not the wrong reasons, but like, you know, in terms of what we're going to talk about later, in terms of the climate, you know, perhaps it was the wrong reasons given what I was doing at the time. But I got what I needed. You know, I was much more able to focus. And then, as often happens, apparently according to the researchers, the intentions for my practice changed, went from self-regulation to self-exploration. And I started to become more curious. about what was going on in my mind, about who and what I was, about my position in the world. And the greater awareness and sensitivity that I was developing, I think, stopped the kind of biases and defense mechanisms that I had, particularly around climate and sustainability. Like, I didn't want to know. I was sort of aware of the facts. You know, I have friends who were really into it. I kind of wanted to be the kind of person who cared. But I also, you know, I also was someone who thought it was no problem just wanting to be a chief executive in an advertising agency. Anyway, that all changed when, yeah, I think that I had to turn towards the difficult, as mindfulness teachers sometimes say. That's one of the things this is a training in. And what was difficult for me was hearing about climate change. But I read a book, and that changed my life. I quit my job and ended up volunteering initially and then getting a job in a climate campaign. So it was quite a rapid turnaround. And in between, there was a bit of like just taking time off and doing lots of meditation, a kind of dark night of the soul where I was really asking deep questions. And that's when everything was different. That was the really big turnaround. Worked in a climate campaign.
I asked what book?
Hey?
What book was the name of the book?
Oh, right. Yeah. So it's a book called Heat by George Monbiot. And this was around 2009, I guess, 2008 maybe. And by 2010, yeah, I was working for a climate campaign. And yeah, I could go on, but I guess that was the big turnaround for me. The second, perhaps most important one, is that when I was working in climate change, that world was really finally letting go of what they call the information deficit hypothesis. You know, this idea that humans are rational beings. And that we, you know, we are homo economicus, as the economists call us, that we act in enlightened self-interest in a rational way, which is obviously nonsense. it's pretty clear now. And so I was disillusioned amongst everybody else, like, you know, just saying the facts isn't going to do what we need, telling people the facts. And that's where the inner dimension came in. It was like, we are more complicated than we thought we were. Our emotions, our social interactions, our embodiedness are all impacting our decision-making, our biases and defense mechanisms. And that is a psychological cultural question that wasn't really being asked properly within climate policy or climate science. And I looked at myself and thought, why did I go from making commercials for SUVs to trying to convince people to ditch their SUVs, you know, within a year or two? And for me, it was the inner shift, and it was the mindfulness that supported it.
Advertising and mindfulness sounds an interesting synergy. We often hear about mindfulness, but it's different for everyone. Can you give us a peek into your own mindfulness routine and how it impacts your daily life?
Yeah, sure. I mean, this morning is a good example. Because I didn't do what I normally do, which is have a big, long meditation in the morning. And over time, I found that the more I've given to practice up to a certain point, and that point for me is over an hour, like that time is worthwhile. Like, I make better decisions, I make fewer mistakes, I have better relationships, and that just makes me more productive and saves time over the long run. So that hour is won back, I guess, by just being much better at what I do. At least that's my perception of it. But then this morning, I got the time wrong with this interview. So we're speaking quite relatively early in the morning here. I thought it was 9:30. It's 8, you know, it's actually 8:30. And so I really practiced mindfulness through my morning routine. So I'm not going to have a time for a big, long sit today. But I can try and develop that centeredness, that stability of mind, that awareness and presence by deepening and reinforcing my intention to do so. And that's one of the things that's going on with my mindfulness practice, really. It's like valuing and strongly intending to stay present with what's going on for us in the here and now, with particular attitudes. And those attitudes are with curiosity, with openness, with kindness, and a sense of allowing things to be as they are right now. Doesn't mean you allow things to continue being as they are right now. You know, you act in the world. But in this exact moment, things are as they are, and fighting with them, wrestling with that, leads to distress and leads to often distorted perceptions of how things actually are. Like you try and make things as you want them to be, not as they really are. And that goes for climate change as well. It's important that we are realistic about how things are, rather than, you know, trying to make them how we want to be in this moment and then work with them as they are. So mindfulness is a natural human capacity, natural inner capacity that we can develop intentionally, that we can make stronger. That is most commonly through formal practice, where we sit for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour, strengthening that muscle. Or it's something, and it's something that you that is practiced through the day, you know, brushing your teeth, in relationship, to really listen to someone, to listen to your own bodily signals, that what your body's telling you at the same time as what someone's saying, the conceptual content. And that's a kind of level of mastery which unlocks a level of presence and relating, which is really powerful. And also, mindfulness is just one of a range of things that we can cultivate in the heart and mind. So it's sometimes described as a kind of umbrella term itself, because we talk about it including care, as I mentioned, and curiosity, and a kind of stability of mind, a collectedness of mind. And you can split those things out and talk about them separately and focus on them separately. And you can train in compassion, and you can train in insight, developing understanding of the mind in ways that fundamentally and irrevocably change our relationship to ourselves, our constellation of what we even call the self, and our view of the self, in ways that unlock deep freedom and skillfulness in the world. And for that, you know, there are many different paths. For me, I've studied Buddhism, I've trained to teach in that tradition, but then I also, you know, have also been sort of practiced in Christian mysticism and Vedic and other things as well. So there's a lot of wisdom traditions in this world. Many of their insights are being validated by science. You know, mindfulness alone has 20,000 or so academic peer-reviewed papers on the subject. You know, this stuff is no longer weird, and it's available to you. So I'd encourage anyone to have at least some path of practice, some way in which you know what you want to cultivate, what you want to bring more of into your life, whether it's compassion and care, or it's collectedness, calmness, or presence and awareness, or anything really. What are you practicing, and how are you learning to better do that, is a question I would ask all your listeners.
As you said, mindfulness is an ancient practice, and finally, maybe, I don't want to say it's too late, but in the Western society, it's normalized. It's, as you said, it's in science, it's accepted. Do you think this might be the time for humanity to be much closer to have the opportunity to practice mindfulness? But at the same time, when you think about our daily life and social media, and you know, is there a tension there?
Yeah, it's, you know, to quote a famous novel, you know, it is the best of times and it is the worst of times in that regard, because we've never had greater opportunities to learn from the wisdom traditions of the world. Like, never before have they come together into a big melting pot of, you know, globalized modernist culture to exchange principles and to work on ways to make that more and more accessible to people, whether it's through classes or apps or, you know, retreat centers. The average person in the world has never had a greater opportunity to learn from deep wisdom traditions, which used to be largely cloistered within monasteries, mainly accessible by men. And so that's fantastic. You know, I used to work for Headspace, a meditation app, and their ambition was to rebrand meditation, you know, to get it out there and push further out into, you know, into cultures and part of the mainstream cultures, which are the most circumspect about such things. And they've done a fantastic job. And also that very platform, the digital platform that enables us to access Headspace particularly, is also the same platform that's delivering us so much distracting, fragmenting, capturing content that triggers us intentionally, that charges our emotions, that hacks and sometimes weaponizes our most basic drives and innate impulses, which have disrailed our best intentions for civilization, for the length of civilization. You know, the Greeks talked about this. How can we make our best intentions, the better angels of our nature, that live in service of good, beauty, and truth? Like, how can we give, tip things in their favor rather than the favor of the drives which evolved on a prehistoric landscape, which helped us survive and procreate, but which aren't that suited now for a modern landscape, you know? They evolved in the savannah to propagate our genes, but now make us miserable or make us vulnerable to hijack, to capture by hostile states, by companies, by political actors who don't have our best interests at heart. And that's, you know, but then also just making us generally fragmented and distracted. We kind of, I mean, on another level, that difficulty can make us more likely to actually practice, because we can see that, oh, I need some mind training here to be able to deal with this, or at least like tip things in the favor of this sort of psychological defense that I need. Mm. So yeah, best of times and the worst of times there.
So in one of your articles, you brought national politicians to take part in a mindfulness training. That's a hilarious and an exciting combo. Can you tell me more about this? What was it like getting politicians involved in mindfulness training?
Yeah, so there's lots of people involved in this initiative, and I have to say that I'm not the one who did the mindfulness teaching on this program. I was one of the volunteers and experts who came together after they had already been practicing in the British Parliament in 8-week mindfulness courses delivered by the Oxford University Mindfulness Centre. I was one of the volunteers and experts who came together to help them, politicians, to inquire into what the implications were of what they'd been learning in their personal lives, in their personal practices. Often it's said that mindfulness isn't taught, it's caught. So if you get the bug, and you're like, often, at least it was back then, the question was like, why don't more people know about this? This is profound. Like, this has really helped me. How do I share this? And for politicians, the obvious answer to that question is like public policy. Like how can this better be deployed in hospitals and schools and prisons, in workplaces? And that question I helped them inquire into, first of all, through the world's first policy inquiry about mindfulness training or about meditation in general, or really about the kind of inner cultivation in a rigorous way that we're kind of aware of. And we produced a public policy report called Mindful Nation UK. And it looked at those four policy areas I mentioned: health, education, criminal justice, and the workplace. Looked at the evidence, looked at where it's being applied, looks at the social problems it could be better applied for, and the evidence base for that, and made recommendations for change. That really interested people around the world, and caught the interest of politicians in other parliaments, who invited me and members of parliament from the UK to go and present to politicians in France and Iceland and Denmark and, you know, across Nordic countries particularly, but also Australia, Canada, US, UAE, Sri Lanka. Like, it was a really interesting time as we went on this sort of, like, you know, Global Roadshow. And in about 10 of those countries, there was enough interest to start up mindfulness training there as well. And yeah, so it's been a real ride. It's been a great privilege to, I took over sort of being director of the Mindfulness Initiative after the first few months of that development of the public policy report. And so since about 2014, 15, until last year, I was director of the Mindfulness Initiative. And we went on from writing public policy reports about areas where the evidence was strongest and clearest, like health, to looking at some of the more complex, you know, wider reaching societal issues like sustainability, like climate change. And so ultimately I was able to marry this new public policy role that I had with my initial inspiration from climate campaigning world. And so a couple of years ago, released a report called Reconnection, Meeting the Climate Crisis Inside Out. So yeah, there's lots I could say about both how mindfulness landed in politics and also that policy work. So
it's really cool.
If you're interested in.
Mindfulness is often associated with spiritual growth and curiosity, while politics operates within that professional, bit of the bureaucratic realm. How do you envision mindfulness intersecting with governmental processes, and how do you see these two worlds overlapping?
Yeah. You know, there's a great report that came out last year around the same time as we published a report summarizing the effects of 10 years of the mindfulness program in the British Parliament. And this other report is called Mere Mortals. It's about the mental health of politicians worldwide. And I love that phrase, mere mortals, you know, because one of the first insights that I got when I started working in politics was like, wow, these are humans too. Like, politicians are humans too, and they're vulnerable and have a lot of the same hang-ups and issues and fears as we do. And a lot of them are doing something quite heroic at a time when it is really nasty to be a politician. On the whole, threats of physical violence, a social media world which is just toxic, terrible work-life balance, a thankless task where there is a breakdown in public trust and a very poor relationship between the public and politicians. And the vast majority, at least that I've come in contact with, are doing it for the right reasons. They're doing it because they think they know or have a view that will make society better. We might disagree with that view, but the vast majority are doing it for reasons of service. You know, it might be in service of the whole of humanity. It might be in the service of a particular interest group, but it is service. And so one of the things that mindfulness and compassion training and other things like this can do is just help with, you know, resilience and to support them to get through it, to be well on our behalf. Like, the complexity that they have to navigate, the decisions they have to make are so nuanced and complex. Even if they present that to the public in quite straightforward ways, because they have to, they're holding vast complexity. And we need them to be as well as possible. So that's the first thing. And we don't, on the whole, when I say we, I mean like particularly the media or mainstream culture in their weird countries, you know, sort of Western educated, particularly, that's the milieu that I know best. We have very little sympathy. And so a world where these practices support them to be more robust and healthy is one thing. In our report, which we called Mindfulness in Westminster, Reflections from UK Politicians, we published it last September. So this was on the back of semi-structured interviews with politicians, asking them what they thought the impact was over this last 10 years. And they told us, yes, there's this resilience benefit. They told us about two other categories of benefit. The other one was interpersonal. So how this shows up in their relationships with family members, with friends, but particularly, you know, colleagues and constituents and people they have to relate to on a daily basis. How can I show up and be present, be compassionate with my constituents who are telling me horrible things? Like, I've been, you know, living a very heady life in Parliament through the week, debating, having to, you know, digest huge amounts of information. Then on Friday, UK politicians have to go back to their constituencies and listen to loads of cases of where they, someone needs their help. And how do I listen with compassion and care? It's a real challenge. You've got to be very dexterous to shift tracks and have very different sort of modes of mind and heart. That's just one example of the benefits that they told us about. The ability to listen, the ability to work with conflict and to disagree better with each other. And that leads us to the kind of third category of benefit, which is around culture. Now, it's sort of early days, 300 members of Parliament and members of the House of Lords have now been on a mindfulness course or had some mindfulness training in the UK Parliament. But that can be misleading because there are so many MPs and members of the House of Lords in the UK system that actually that's still a fraction of the sitting members. But it's about sort of 10% or so have had some training. And they tell us that amongst those who have been on this course, the culture is different. Like the quality of debating in the chamber is different. They say this: I have seen demonstrations of people acting quite differently to how I imagined they might have done a few years previous. Calling for calm in a chamber that was baying for blood, you know, saying like, you know, stick the boot in, go on, like give him a, you know, and this person, you know, Tim Lawton, a Conservative MP, during a Brexit debate was just like, calm, gave himself a breath, a couple of beats, and then very calmly asked a question which took a lot of the heat and, you know, potentially unproductive heat out of the room. And there's another member of Parliament on the Labour benches who says, you know, I used to be like a heckler, one of the most disruptive members in the chamber, and so much so that he was described like that in newspapers, becomes, you know, a real proponent of mindfulness. And the Speaker of the House of Commons says, after this gentleman, Chris Ruan, asked a question about mindfulness to the Prime Minister, the Speaker of the House of Commons says, we are very grateful to the honourable gentleman. He's obviously a practitioner of mindfulness himself. He's a much more calm and phlegmatic fellow these days. We're very grateful. So even the Speaker had noticed that he had changed. And they say that behind the scenes, yeah, that it's not about being any less ideological or having any less disagreement in the ideas, but it's about reducing what scientists call affective polarisation. Reducing the amount we dislike or distrust others simply because we disagree with them. So we can actually sort of disentangle our different ideas from our kind of different identities or different, you know, disliking people. And there's evidence, quantitative evidence showing that mindfulness reduces affective polarization. And the work of Simonson points towards that.
In your personal opinion, do you believe that mindful politics is something that can actually exist?
I mean, it remains to be seen, you know. I mean, like, we've seen these green shoots, which are like so early days compared to the great cultural inertia that we've got, particularly in these old democracies where people have sat opposite each other in chambers that were made to be confrontational rather than, like, you know, in a semicircle or in the round like we've got in the, you know, these confrontational structures in the UK, both physical and cultural. And politics sits within the context of the media and public understanding and appetite for a different sort of politics, you know, and the mechanics of social media and the little clips that get shared around. Like, there's only so much that sort of enlightened individuals within that system can do to shift things without also working at the level of public discourse, public culture, media culture. But I think in the round, over time, yes, of course, we live in a relative utopia today compared to how we lived at the beginning of the parliamentary system. You know, the benches in Parliament in the UK in Westminster are that distance apart because of the length of the sword arm. Like, it's more difficult to stab each other on the other side of the chamber when benches are far enough apart. I think that's what it was, like, basically. So yeah, if that was a real design principle, I mean, that might just be a folk, you know, folk myth, but this is certainly what I've been told on tours of Parliament. If a design principle was that we shouldn't kill each other in the chamber, we've come a long way today. And in so many other ways, we've come a long way. Do you know what I mean? Like, life expectancy has gone up from 30 or 40 to 70 or 80, et cetera, et cetera. So, but yes, I believe that if more people practice things like mindfulness and start to themselves value those things as a result, then we'll start to see an appetite for politicians to display them more. Mm. And that will really support them to actually live that.
That's a good answer. In my own meditation practice, I try to break free from the autopilot mode of living, where my actions are dictated by my habits without much conscious thought. And I believe many of us can relate to this. So when considering the environmental issues we face, both locally and globally, national policies are the main navigators. Yet often they stem from past experiences and they have a lessons learned approach, which can lead to a sense of reactivity and rigidity rather than proactive attitude, if that makes sense. Mm. First of all, what are your thoughts on this perspective? And can you talk a bit about how mindfulness might offer a remedy to the inflexibility of rooted policies?
Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting that you focused on that. The cognitive rigidity. It can be cognitive and emotional rigidity and its role in sustainability and in the world. And that's one of the things that we do focus on in our work, looking at mindfulness and compassion training and the inner dimension of sustainability more broadly. We look at particularly cognitive flexibility, perspective taking, openness, curiosity, all things which sort of combat that rigidity. So we published a report called Mindfulness Developing Agency in Urgent Times back in 2020. And that was looking at this inflexibility versus, well, flexibility in terms of what it means for our sense of agency, how we're able to show up and act and create change in the world. Because rigidity means we're stuck, right? And that is not agentic. That is that reduces our degree of our range of possible action, reduces our possibility for creativity and for acting more appropriately. So that's one way of looking at it. Mm. A couple of years yet later, we followed it up with Reconnection, Meeting the Climate Crisis Inside Out. And in there, we talked about rigidity and flexibility again. And this time we talked about it through the lens of connection, because having researched, we consulted with over 100 experts working at the intersection of inner and outer transformation as it relates to sustainability particularly. And we heard that there's lots of different ways of talking about the inner domain or the inner dimension of climate change. But one of the most sort of the one that was winning out was around this sort of separation and disconnection to connection. So the climate crisis can be understood as a relationship crisis primarily at its root. And that relationship crisis is characterized by disconnection and separation, underpinned by some of the very helpful ideas from the Enlightenment and actually going back to the like Greek and Judeo-Christian thought, which separate ourselves from the natural world, from the outer material world in general, from each other and from ourselves. And this crisis of disconnection, being insensible insensitive to the changes that we're having on the other side of the planet or all around us, even disconnection in sort of sensing and many other forms is primarily what's going wrong. And then we said we talk about that in general, and then use mindfulness and compassion training as two examples of ways in which we can reconnect the other cognitive and emotional capacities that help us to connect with self, with each other, and with the world. So in this context, rigidity, inflexibility stops us to being able to connect with different ways of seeing. Stops us to be able to connect with future possibilities. But particularly there's this sort of like this sensory locking in. How we think about things conditions what we're able to see and what can and can't be seen. And so we're unable to connect to how things really are when we have a kind of rigid mindset, if you see what I mean. So that's just a couple of key ways. And in the kind of macro sense, and that I was talking there kind of in terms of the micro sense, as in what it's like for the human heart and mind, in the macro sense, we are locked into a mindset which feels inescapable. Like some people say, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism.
Yeah,
we know it. And it just feels inconceivable that we might choose to arrange things differently. And there's a certain rigidity and clinging to the status quo for lots of different reasons. If politicians and policymakers know anything about the inner dimension of the climate crisis, they know a couple of things. They know our kids are not all right, that there's a lot of climate distress out there. And they often know this word mindset, that somehow there's a mindset underpinning how we operate in the world and that we need to shift that. But it's easier said than done. And working on things like mindfulness, which overcome our automaticity, as you say, and help us to have a more creative, responsive approach rather than a kind of reactive, impulsive lockdown approach could be absolutely key.
One thing you said made me think of, and it was something I haven't thought before. You know, you mentioned the dichotomy between me and I and the other and human and nature and all these binaries. But I never thought about for the self as well, and that how that self is separated.
Yeah. So there are a number of ways in which we are ourselves disconnected. And these different forms of disconnection interrelate with each other. So crucially, our bodies are hugely important, I mean, for empathy, for how we interpret and feel about what we hear and what we see. So when we are empathizing with someone, when we're listening to them, what we're actually doing is listening to the subtle signals that our bodies are telling us. So if we're disconnected from our bodies, and there are scales scientists can assess this, like to the extent to which we are aware of and present to our bodily sensations can be sort of mapped and measured. And those of us who have poor body awareness tend to have poor empathy. And therefore, you know, connecting to ourselves helps us to connect to others. And to nature, to actually be in nature requires a certain self-presence. It's not enough just to turn up into the woods, you know, and start Instagramming things that look cool, but like to actually be present to it all, to be present to the kind of soulfulness and the emotions that come when you allow yourself to actually be in those environments, and the shifting in identity and views that happens when you deeply connect with nature, which, by the way, looks like one of the most impactful things we can do to shift mindsets, shift the dial on care about climate, is nature connection. Those with high nature connection are twice as likely to have sort of climate action attitudes and behaviors. So these things are all interrelated. on the kind of, if we look at the self level, connection to ourselves, there are certain ideas which came through, particularly in the Enlightenment, but like I say, it goes even further back than that. But the Enlightenment really sort of like pulled these together and doubled down on them. And then when I say in the Enlightenment, this is like the 1700s particularly. This is the scientific revolution. This is Francis Bacon, Descartes, and Newton, etc. And, you know, Descartes created what they call that Cartesian dualism, literally splitting off the mind from the material world, because in order to defend it from the reductionism of the scientific method. And also, you know, implicit within the Judean Christian worldview is man, by which we mean man rather than woman, at the apex of the world, in dominion, in domination over nature. And Francis Bacon, when he developed scientific method, explicitly said, this method will allow us to regain our place in dominion over creation so that we can exploit and extract what we want from it, so we can shape nature and dominate it. And so, again, that's a kind of like this splitting off, the scientific method, the reductionism, where we're splitting things into smaller and smaller, more manipulable, exploitable chunks, supercharged this idea that we are separate from nature, and rightly so, in a way that and it kind of simplified and this scientific method, reductionism, separated different parts of complex systems in nature, in ourselves, and we lost a sense for the whole and our impact on the whole and our dependency on the whole.
There has been a significant emphasis on rationality and thinking and cognition, which put emotions and feelings as secondary or unnecessary. Whereas in meditation practice, it is contemplative and it integrates emotions and feelings, and it's a way to connect. It is still contemplative and thinking, but it integrates.
Yes, exactly. And that's what we point to in the Reconnection Report, that there are certain cognitive, emotional, relational capacities which underpin these things. Like, this isn't just, we can't just talk about it and wish connection into being. We actually have to value it and orient towards it and practice it in groups, in cultures, you know, in media context and in our own lives. And I'm working at the moment in another piece of writing for the Club of Rome, who were famous in 1972 for writing the Limits to Growth report. And 50 years on, there's been an update to that. And they've commissioned myself and my co-authors on the Reconnection Report and a few others to write a response to their systems thinking approach to complement it and integrate more the inner. Because sustainability thinking, systems thinking, sustainability policy, particularly out in the kind of, you know, UN and national context, it's all about the outer, all about the external technical things we can do. But we're pointing this to this being at root, not a technical problem. It's a cultural, psychological, and we're implicated in the problem ourselves, the way in which we approach the problem and think about the problem and part of the problem. And therefore it's adaptive. We need to learn and change and grow. This is calling us to learn and change and grow and to solve it at a different order of consciousness from the level it was created. I think that, and that's happening. The UN, so the IPCC report from the UN a couple of years ago, the most recent one, did mention inner transitions for sustainability for the first time. And there were sort of sections in that report looking at the evidence for this sort of inner psychological, cultural shift that is needed and is possible. And we're seeing, you know, UN secretaries talking about mindsets and that kind of thing for the first time. And the inner development goals, as you mentioned, I work leading on public narrative and policy development for the inner development goals, which is a communications framework, a framework for inner skills, qualities, and capacities based on research with sort of thousands of people submitting answers to a survey aims to give people the language and the kind of model or a framework to better include qualities of heart and mind that are important in sustainability challenges. And the UN Development Goals is now partnering with UNFCCC, with UNDP, the UN Development Programme, and with national governments, having good conversations with central offices across North America and Europe particularly, about how inner capacities and skills can be developed by federal or national policy programs.
What do you think is necessary for the inner development goals to gain momentum and become a prominent framework?
It's just captured the imagination. It's only really been out for 3 years. It's coming up to the third birthday in May. And in that time, it has really captured the zeitgeist, it's provided something where people have needed an accessible, translatable, or like a framework that can travel between companies, between contexts, between approaches, between different sort of cultures and countries. And work is ongoing at the moment to make this framework even more sort of globally validated. So they're trying to get 1,000 responses from 100, each of 100 different countries across Africa and Asia and South America particularly, so that we have this global language for inner work, inner skills. And it's needed this because up until now, the inner work people have been doing has been through particular prisms. It's been about mindfulness, or it's been about compassion or embodiment or trauma healing, or about sort of vertical development. And there are lots of people with great approaches that have lots of evidence base and are really important, but it's quite a complex landscape and difficult to talk about and to advocate to your financial director and get the budgets for, that kind of thing. But here we have something that actually, because this originated in Sweden, there's a great sort of very Scandinavian analogy of a beer bottle in a sauna. So the sauna, right, is sort of pregnant with potential. It's got this humid atmosphere, but you can't see it. And you can't even feel it that much. But as soon as an ice cold beer bottle comes into the sauna, like suddenly you're seeing torrents of water like cascading off the side because it's all condensed. And the Inner Development Goals project has been a little bit like that. Like it's been a lightning rod for this kind of like over ready field to have something to be able to have this kind of global conversation through. So to be honest, it doesn't need that much help. Like it's got partners in the leading business schools, sustainability centers, UN agencies, national governments, and a lot is being asked of it. The expectations are almost too high. It's largely a legitimizing project, a communications project, but now we need researchers and innovators and people to come through and say, okay, so now this conversation's opened up. Where do we then go with this? How do we support these groups to actually do the work in communities, in programs? That's the big question now.
Let's dream big for a moment. Can you imagine what the world would look like if mindfulness became a standard or a dominant practice in political and also in society?
Yeah, sure. There's an awful lot of visionary stuff said about this. And then there's the evidence base. So on the one hand, the Dalai Lama says if we taught every child to meditate, war would be extinct, would be obsolete in a couple of generations, and people like Jon Kabat-Zinn, the godfather of secular scientific mindfulness, talks about this link between individual health and planetary health, and that a second renaissance could be triggered if we had really diligent cultivation of heart and mind in the way that mindfulness courses and compassion courses, etc., point towards. And I think there's a lot of validity in that. The challenge is that, you know, that's quite straightforward to do. Everyone just needs to meditate. And in the same way that, like, the climate change is quite straightforward, everyone just needs to stop using fossil fuels. I mean, to stop, you know, treating things as externalities, and we can just forget about the harm we're creating in all sorts of ways. It's quite straightforward, but it's not at the same time. It's an adaptive problem. And the same as, like, you know, finding approaches that are actually effective and actually accessible to people. We haven't got there yet. Well, what we're starting to see is that those people who practice mindfulness have enormous benefit. But if you try and roll this out in schools in the way that we currently have it, in a kind of like shallow and super scalable way, it doesn't seem to work the same way. So it's complex. But that's kind of a caveat, basically, instead of saying it's you know. But if we could develop the approaches that actually people got on with, that understood individual differences, that understood that some people have trauma patterns, which mean that they need different approaches than others, you know. If we could nail all of that and everyone did find a practice which helped them develop heart and mind, we would see what humanity is capable of. Capable of handling better complexity, capable of like healing our trauma patterns, which are intergenerational, which really hold us back. Capable of relating and collaborating in ways currently inconceivable. And yet, the evidence base on the programs we currently have tend to be measures that are quite small. I mean, quite kind of individualized and more limited. So I'm often minded that anything you propose tends to be dismissed as either feasible but trivial or utopian and unrealistic. Because people miss the kind of the programmatic view that connects those things together. Very little, unless you get this kind of like knife edge sweet spot in between feasible and visionary, that somehow people think it's impactful and also it's you know, doable and evidence based. But it's such a sweet spot, it almost doesn't exist. That as soon as you start talking about visionary statements, you get dismissed. And as soon as you talk about feasible things that are evidence-based, they're like, oh, that's nice. It's the weak balm of self-improvement, though, and won't do anything. So I think these visionary statements are pointing to something, and we need a programmatic view that helps people to practice and helps us to get better at developing approaches that actually shift the dial, that are actually able to fit into people's lives and to take them from where they are to their full potential. And engaging them not as people, not as objects to be acted upon, to be changed, but as, you know, agents with their own longings, with their own deeper potential that you can help them to unlock and to orient towards. Because I do believe it is once we're sort of shown that possibility in that way, we do all have an innate desire to grow, to become more of ourselves, and to foster the better angels of our nature. And this perhaps is something to leave with, because one of the saving graces and one of the causes for optimism is fundamentally, it is a lot more pleasant to be nice to each other. That actually, generosity, kindness, care, freedom, openness, and the things that come with it lead to less suffering, much greater happiness. And we just need to give people tastes of that. And we will naturally orientate towards it. That actually, hatred, contraction, distress, these things that divide and lead to distress, they're relatively grosser and more superficial, surface level mental phenomena. And they're deeply unpleasant for the person who is the one who's being the aggressor or whatever, compared to the opposite. And if we just develop the awareness to see that, the world could be radically different.
Jamie, thank you so much for your time. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Me too. Me too. Really did. Thank you. Thank you.